So when do I get started? Let me just say a couple of words about what it is that we're planning to do. We took very seriously the idea that this is a discussion and not a lecture presentation. Either they or I are certainly happy to talk in more detail about some of the computational questions or issues or algorithms or software or all kinds of other questions in particular areas that we have interest in. I'm sure there are other people here who know more about other aspects of things that I want to talk about. I want to try to avoid excessive or even any kind of quantification. But we sat down over the last couple of days to try and think about what it is we wanted to go over today, in part driven by Shelley's encouragement that over the past few weeks, various things have come up that people have had questions about gene analysis, genome sequencing, assembly, annotation, data integration, phylogeny reconstruction, various kinds of things. And there's lots of infrastructure available for all of those things that's increasingly used by lots of different people. And I, for one, don't claim to be an expert in most of those areas, but I'm certainly happy to sit down with people individually and talk about what we do, as I'm sure Isaiah or other people do those kinds of things. What seemed to us more sensible to talk about today, rather than here's how you map RNA-seq data to genomes, or here's how you generate a phylogeny, was to think about some general principles and ways that might be of interest to people here of very different backgrounds. So what we thought we might do is just go over the points that have come up to us, which we can certainly revise based on any comments that people have here, and I put some notes up on the blackboard. And then Jose and I were going to each take a few minutes to say something about what our particular interest is and areas, and then we can have some more time for general discussion. And if that doesn't resonate with people, then we'll have a short afternoon discussion and get back to whatever else we're doing. And if it does, we can take it in whatever direction we want to. So I wrote up on the board the things that basically reconstructing what was on the blackboard in the office that we conveniently share. And we thought that we wanted to particularly focus on issues of what we're doing computationally, particularly in the context of evolutionary cell biology, obviously. What are the questions we ought to ask? When do we want to do them, but when things have occurred in evolutionary time, and how issues about mechanism. So the root of all of this is, of course, the data that we want to take a look at. And that data includes all sorts of different data. It includes phenotypic data of the kind that biologists have always looked at. And it includes things like genomic scale data sets and what makes this computational is that all of these are, for today's purposes, we're talking about large scale data sets, not the kinds of things that we can easily interpret. The anecdote that I tell sometimes to various audiences to try to illustrate the point, although everyone here recognizes the issue, is I describe, some of you have met my wife, Anurag, who joined me here. We met as graduate students together. She was the sort of star of our graduate student class. All of us were very jealous of her. She published four papers in Nature and Cell and Science in her first year as a graduate student. And what she basically got her PhD for was running a northern blot. looking at the transcript analysis of one or a few proteins or transcripts. It was one of the world's first northern blots, and it was a fairly big deal, but it basically took years to figure out how to do the experiment and weeks to figure out what it means. And of course, with our arrays or RNA-seq data, we routinely generate hundreds of millions of northern blots in an afternoon in the lab, which doesn't mean that our students get hundreds of millions of PhDs in an afternoon. It's just that it takes us weeks to generate data and years to figure out what the hell it all means, which obviously involves a lot of computational work and also has some philosophical differences in terms of how data is accessed and released and credit and publication and a gazillion other things that we could talk about, although some of that might be more appropriate for discussion, discussion over a beer. The other thing we wanted to include in here is some contact of maybe let's just say the dynamics or time dimension of these phenomics and omic data. We're interested in trying to layer that on top, this information on top of evolutionary questions, asking particularly about phylogeny. And obviously would like to try to get at questions of mechanism, and those may be genetic mechanisms or physiological mechanisms or whatever. And in order to do that, we need a very much better understanding of what the constraints are on our systems in ways that makes sense, especially for these large-scale data sets that are hard to wrap our heads around. And I think some of the things, I just put in a somewhat random list of the kinds of tools that we'd like to be able to apply to these data sets. They include population genetic tools, tools for genome sequencing and assembly and annotation and other kinds of omics data sets for transcriptomics or whatever other kind of omics you'd like to design. Identification of worth logs, which I'll talk more about next week, but by which we mean genes that arose, genes that diverged by virtue of speciation as opposed to duplication and neo or subfunctionalization. And all of that requires things like databases and tools for data integration, and we'll probably come back at the end to talk more about various logistical issues about what it means to make data accessible or tools portable or metrics for evaluating utility. So that was kind of the framework that we had in mind. Did I miss out on my list, or are there things that are missing from here that people think we should sort of slot in before we begin discussing? Do you want to? Why don't you start off with, I mean, you talked the other day, so you have some kind of what people are, why don't you?
So what we decided to do here was just to give you an idea of how we end up being worried about this issue of infrastructure. So I just put these three slides together to tell you how I end up doing this, because neither me nor David come from a formal training in IT or physics or math or anything. I'm a biochemist by training, so. But at some point, I started realizing, I put this here of life coming out of the mathematics closet, because for those of you that know me for longer, I was always in denial. I'm not a mathematician. I reject that title. It turns out I realized I spent most of my professional life developing bioinformatics tools. And then I thought that maybe I should just accept that's what I do and what I am. But I think what you guys probably have this notion is that there's lots of tools out there, so you want to study sequence evolution. There's a whole mature framework out there. But now the moment you start trying to address those questions of what, it turns out that those tools very rarely actually very suitable for your specific problem. These are great generic tools. And we found ourselves having to develop specific say, tailor existing methods to be used in specific situations, for example, dealing with highly duplicated gene families and sorting Bichet mapping morphology, or dealing with signals where the evolutionary signal is not very clear, like the choroidal domains that I briefly mentioned, that we have to develop new substitution models. So I think that even at the sequence level, if you want to address those basic questions over there, there's quite a lot to be done. Talent, particularly once we get to more exotic branches of field of life, like you were just telling us earlier on. But I think what really makes it to, that's what sort of made it for me, and this is where I decided, David told you, tell you what we're interested on, is about phenotypic data. And I get to realize that, A, there's a huge, as a non-biologist, I did not know this, but there's a huge tradition of morphological analysis in biology. This is what biology used to be like. And people who did this, I want to stress, they completely changed the world, the way that we see the world. And the organelles, when we start to think about cellular life, we start looking at things like this. This is the same data types. We're just looking at stuff. It just turns out that we don't really have good means to describe what is out there, diversity, the variation, or in this particular case that I'm showing you here, pathological variation in the context of cancer, where these structures that Monica is telling you about, they change a lot morphologically in the numbers. So when we start studying them, what we had to do was to basically come up with new ways of representing knowledge. In this particular case, it was ontologies. I'm very happy to tell you about those ontologies afterwards, what they are and how they're used. But I think this is, to me, one of the biggest problems. I think that I'm most interested in the space of my life is how do you represent biological information, biological space. And so ontologies are really good if you want to describe static things. They have a lot of advantages, but the issue of dynamic data, you, particularly for the more quantitative people around here, you may think that you have really good ways of representing quantitative data, but we have no ways of telling you that this specific pathway is, from a dynamic perspective, more similar to this one to that one, and it is very objective. And I'm sure that these methods exist out there. Biology does not invent new problems, it just makes them complex. And so I think that from what we need somehow is get to understand where are these methods to compare dynamic, to represent and compare dynamic systems, how can we adapt them, say, biochemical reactions. There's this database issue that I think that we talk more about because they represent some of the challenges. It's something which I think that, you know, as Michael made more and more aware, is this issue, if you want to claim selection, you know, what do you say, and this need for neutral models of evolution, that the moment you go into phenotypic space, they're not as obvious as the ones that we have to study sequence variation. But that does not mean that they don't exist, as we more and more with Mike start realizing that popular genetics has the answer for almost everything. And I'm sure, again, that yet that there's other frameworks out there that we can probably use to conceptualize morphological or phenotypic variation and understanding in the context of variation. And the final thing, so this is, if you tell me, this part here is probably what I'm at this point trying to really change my group to completely focus on that. Because I think this is where the big challenges are. And something I'd just like to make a final personal annoyance, grievance that I have is that everybody is very, find it very easy to state. If you look at the tree, you make statements about the tree without having formal methods about what those ancestral states. The formal methods for sequences, there are formal methods for any type of trait. We somehow tend to think that the moment we leave sequences, we are allowed to do just eyeballing trees. And I think that we've decided trying to adapt some methods into morphological states in cells, but there is clearly here a lot of scope to take probably existing frameworks from statistics and bring them here to biology. So this is basically the take I want. I'd like to explore more on this discussion. I stop here. So maybe just do your personal thing and then we should stop there.
So I haven't given the talk here about what we do in my lab yet, and I'm not planning on talking about that at length today. I'll talk next week about some of the research interests in lab, which follow on nicely from the kind of diversity that you heard from Julius. But just to provide some context, I'll show you another phylogenetic tree about these eukaryotic superdomains that Julius described earlier. And the flagellates that Julius talked about are grouped over here in the excavates. My lab has worked on a phylum known as the Apicomplexa, which includes what we used to say was many thousands of species, but now seems likely to be hundreds of thousands of species from environmental sampling studies, only a few thousand of which are known, and most of which I couldn't tell you anything about, but which we're increasingly getting genomic data from. These include the organisms that are responsible for malaria and for toxoplasmosis, and I'll tell you more about some of these things later on. But I'll show you just one more biological slide, which summarizes a long history of work in my lab, and which has helped to crystallize for me our work in the informatics sector. And this is work that several people have referred to previously in the characterization of an organelle now known as the apicoplast for apicomplexum plastid, a secondary endosymbiotic organelle acquired when an ancestral malaria parasite, or in fact the precursor to all of the alveolates, including ciliates and dinoflagellates and apicomplexums, ate or was invaded by a eukaryotic alga and retained the algal plastid as an essential organelle. And this is of interest for a bunch of different reasons, not least of which the fact that from a cell biological perspective, it's not every day you discover a new organelle, which is kind of cool. And from a practical perspective, it's not every day that you find an organelle that is essential in organisms you're trying to kill, like malaria parasites. We wanted to know what it did, and the long series of work that I won't go into either today or next week helped to define that. All of this work is published. But the point was, the most important point for today is that these were sort of fundamentally integrative studies that combined morphological studies like is electron micrographs, including morphology that was done long ago, some of it before I was born, that identified what we now know to be this organelle, and pharmacological work also done before I was born that identified drugs that are known to kill malaria parasites in ways that you wouldn't expect. These are antibacterial antibiotics that you wouldn't expect would work against a eukaryote. And emerging phylogenetic approaches and cut-and-paste molecular genetic techniques that allowed us to define what goes where in these cells. And that left us with a challenge of trying to figure out what this organelle did, which we approached in several ways, all of the ways you would think about purifying the organelle to characterize biochemical phenotypes and developing genetic tagging strategies to try and figure out what they would do. But what, in fact, turned out to be far and away the most successful approach was an informatic approach, integrating the information that came from all of these sources. So we knew, for example, that as something that was derived from a plant or cyanobacterial ancestor, the functions associated with this then mysterious organelle might show some phylogenetic signal associated with plants and algae. We knew something about the targeting signals that were responsible for trafficking to the organelle, a bipartite targeting signal that's now been well worked out and which we didn't discover either, but had been hypothesized in other organisms, but in a genetically tractable organism we were actually able to test. So I compiled this in a sort of single slide with lots of animations because to me it seems like a really great success story of what is fundamentally evolutionary cell biology of integrating various different types of information
to go in a relatively short period of time from cell biological, pharmacological, and molecular biological mysteries to drugs that are currently in clinical trials. As I say, all of the details of that from my lab are published. There's nobody in my lab working on the apicoplast now. But the point is that in our efforts to try to integrate information computationally that relied on these targeting information and phylogenetic information, the origin of this was a really embarrassingly simple Perl script that I actually wrote that took all the emerging genome sequence data that we had available at that time, which was in about 1995, I think, and blasted against GenBank and asked for anything that hit at any level of implausible statistical significance, something as a top hit that had the term chloroplast or plant or plasted in the def line. And that day, or like 2 days later, because it took a while to run, we learned everything that we now know about the metabolic pathway. We believe we now have a complete metabolic pathway map. And of course, it took many years beyond that to identify and in some cases crystallize and solve and characterize the enzymes that are involved, but the computational approaches were pretty successful. And as these and other people started to ask, why can't we do that for our functions or genes of interest? And that's what gave rise to one of our early forays into the A-base world, which was the Plasmodium genome database that was constructed in a few months, was originally distributed on CD. If anybody remembers what those are, that's a CD over here. Last year, I came across one of these still in use, actually, in a college course in Senegal. It was actually still functional. And there were lots of things that, in retrospect, were just embarrassingly naive about the approach that we took here. Certainly, it was not very sophisticated from a computational standpoint. It was not very efficient. We used to think that in 2000 or whatever, we used to think that things like the hits on the website were informative statistics about usage, which they're absolutely not. But the overall goal, and certainly the theme that I want to try to emphasize today, is that our overall goal was to try to allow people to ask their own questions, even if they seem like kind of stupid questions, and even if they're not professional informaticians, which I'm certainly not. We wanted, right? The goal is not to try to somehow assemble some gigantic a compendium of everything that malaria is all about, but to try to allow people to ask what seem like nutty questions, like finding plant genes in malaria parasites. So this has turned out to be a pretty successful project. It's been sort of the tail that wags the dog in my lab. Some of you have heard me complain about the amount of time that winds up devoted, as I feel very torn between the cell biology, which I think of as my personal passion and interest, and the fact that these various databases have proved to be useful to lots of different people. There are many, so no longer is this a bunch of Perl scripts written by non-coders like me. This is developed into a production resource, and that's, I think, a really important thing that we need to think about. One of my take-home messages that I want to make is to try to think how we make the tools that all of us wind up developing for our own particular purposes useful to other people. This is an org chart of the database project. How many people here have org charts for their lab? Yeah, I don't. I don't have an org chart for my lab. We have a completely flat sort of hierarchy. I mean, our org, and our just kind of lab meeting, which is a free-for-all. this is a production operation. It's very different from the work that goes on in my lab. It involves people, the different colors indicate where they're paid from and where they sit. They sit all over the world. We, I was telling Julius that we have 70 scheduled hours a week of conference calls for me. Nobody sits in all of them, but it means, you know, the data type development team has staff in Kampala and Glasgow and Georgia, the U.S., and in Philadelphia. And it's a project that's been supported by a whole bunch of different funding agencies and is now under the auspices, primarily as a contract from NIH, not a grant. But the philosophy has remained exactly the same. The amounts of data, the diversity of data have increased very dramatically, but the goal is still to allow people to ask their own questions, and it's, if you're interested in use of statistics, they're more useful statistics than Webmin's site down below. They're something on the order of, I think now, 16,000 unique users per week. Degrading lots of different kinds of data, and again, I'm not going to walk you through how this works. Standing up in front of an audience is kind of a dumb way to look at a dynamic resource that you should sit down with if you're interested. For those of you who may be interested in some organisms of greater diversity than, you know, humans and flies, or even humans and fungi, which from my perspective are more or less the same, there's support for a bunch of reasons. I've talked to a couple of people here about where to access information on Kinetoplastida or Apicomplexa or fungi. But here's an illustration of how this works. So this is the sort of goal, is a graphical user interface that allows people to ask questions. This is not a question of mine. This is a question I don't know anything about. It was driven by some work of students interested in trying to identify candidate vaccine antigens for malaria parasites for obvious reasons. And they've used this interface to be able to ask for things that are genes that are turned on in the right time and in the right place and show the right signatures of selection and phylogenetic distribution and immunological reactivity and I don't know what, that allow them to identify candidates, and we try to encourage collaboration in this by generating a URL. If you were to type in this ugly URL here, you would get back exactly this query strategy, which we try to advocate thinking of as in silico experiments, in this case done as a collaboration by a student in Gambia and a student in Kenya and people in the UK. And like any kind of computational experiment, or like any kind of experiment, we might expect positive controls. The things shown in red are known blood stage antigens that are under exploration as vaccine antigens, and the things shown in yellow are things that known to make sense, and the things shown in green were things that they didn't really know about and have been the subject of further work. So what has made this useful has been that it's fairly easy to use, but you'll notice that there isn't been any kind of statistical analysis here at all. There's a lot of statistics and analysis and data that goes on under the hood that users don't have to look at, but nobody is claiming that you know this antigen, whatever it is going to prove to be a protective anti-malarial vaccine antigen. The goal is really just to provide tools that people can use to ask questions, which kind of gets back at this database point before where Zay had left off. This is a message we've certainly taken to heart in iLab. We've developed lots of tools over the years for things like splice site identification and genome annotation and mapping, and most of that is actually most of those tools, some of which we published papers that show how our tools are better than anybody else's or as good as anybody else's, and have and are now largely forgotten, because what's essential with those tools are going to be used is that they be easily usable. The one tool that we've developed beyond this database architecture that is more widely used relates to ortholog identification. Some of you are familiar with the OrthoMCL database, which I think is probably the most widely used database for identifying orthologs in eukaryotes. It builds on the really seminal work that Gene Coonan and others had done on defining orthologous groups based on reciprocal blast hits, and there are a bunch of peculiarities that may make that not work very well for eukaryotes that some people here will be familiar with, of domain architecture and random duplication and intron structure and inadequate annotation and incomplete sequencing. OrthoMCL gets a lot of criticism. I'm happy to talk about the algorithm for anyone who's interested. I'm particularly happy to talk about it with anyone who might be interested in ways to improve it, because there are a million and one ways that this ought to be improved. It wasn't developed as something very sophisticated, but it was developed to meet a need, and what has made it so widely used and cited has been that it's relatively easy to use. And so that, again, is my plea to people here, is if you have tools that are as good as you think they are and as useful to other people as you think they should be, it really warrants thinking about how to actually get those into practice. And that's usually not done by, so the students who developed this, Feng Chen, who's now at Bayer, and Li Li, who's now at Genentech, weren't responsible for porting this into production when it proved to be a useful tool as the database group, which consists of people that wouldn't be here and most of you have never met. They're software engineers and DBAs and user interface specialists, put this together in a tool that makes it relatively easy to ask questions like, for example, finding plant genes in malaria parasites. We're here running a query to ask for things that are found in organisms that have the apicoplasm, Plasmodium, Theileria, Toxoplasma, missing from Cryptosporidium, which has lost it, present in at least one plant or alga. This is an old slide. There are many more taxa now represented, and that gives back a list of things, including from this sort of in silico experiment, a bunch of things that we now know to be true positives. So I think that, so let me say just one final thing here, which seems sort of a non sequitur, but I thought I would put in the slides that I put together for the group I was visiting just before coming here. Some of you know I came here from Colombia, where I was at a malaria meeting and then had been asked to give a talk to a group of sort of public policy implementation specialists. So you may think that this is a diverse group of people, of mathematicians and physicists and biologists and biochemists, but I have no business talking to people who, you know, worry about the logistics of driving trucks around to spray for mosquitoes, or what the economic cost is and how you manage those things. And so I tried to make the case, this is actually a picture from Peru, not from Colombia, but whatever, that fundamentally, what we're doing here is shopping, right? We're not shopping for, so we're shopping for genes, but we might also want to shop for other things, and of course, increasingly, we do so online. We're all used to going to websites and deciding to buy a plane ticket based on what airlines we want to take and where we want to go and what time we want to fly and how much legroom you need and whether it has power or wireless access. So one of the things that we did, and the reason these folks in Colombia were interested in this, was they wanted to ask whether, we were asked whether the tools that we developed to ask our particular questions find genes that might be involved in the, by the cell biology of the apicoplast and toxoplasma, and then other people might be interested in to find genes that might be relevant for vaccine development for malaria, could be applied for different purposes altogether. So here is a, what you'll recognize as a clone of the website that I showed earlier, but it's been rebranded to integrate data from the International Centers of Excellence in Malaria Research, and there's absolutely nothing at all about genes here for the present, but integrating information on participants, study participants and dwellings and clinical visits, and the point is that all of this is just data. And we can ask the same kinds of questions about that data that we ask about other data. So we've done this for a couple of groups now, asking for things like longitudinal cohort studies for a clinical study in Uganda that involved many hundreds of individuals in towns, various different towns, and questions about all kinds of data that they collect on what sorts of houses people live in, or what their socioeconomic level is, or where they get their drinking water, or how many times they get bitten by mosquitoes, or how many of them are infected by malaria parasites, and of course the same framework for their human genotype or the parasite genotype, or how many times they visited and what other clinical diagnoses they've had. So we could look at whether malaria, which I've asked and filtered on here, is associated with upper respiratory tract infections, and asked similar kinds of questions. So this was a question that that a field site researcher from Uganda wanted to ask, which was what the age distribution was of individuals who are infected with malaria but don't get sick. As you're probably aware, not only do we not have a vaccine for malaria, nor do we have as wide an armamentarium of drugs that we would like to have, but a vaccine for malaria would look very different from a vaccine for measles, where a single exposure protects you for life. In individuals who live in the area where this guy works, who get bitten by one infected mosquito every day, year round, after hundreds of exposures, they still are infected, but they're no longer sick. And we wanted to ask what the age distribution is, so we can ask for individuals who are malaria positive by blood smear here, or we can ask by PCR, but who do not have a fever, and look at their age distribution, and then in on this, and can see that for these kids in this study, that by the time they get to be about 7 years old, they typically have parasites but no fever. And we could ask many more questions like that. He also wanted to know whether this had anything to do with the houses they lived in. So this is an analysis of these are just some our tools that were layered on top of the database to interrogate the underlying data, asking about what the age is of individuals with their first bout of asymptomatic parasitemia. This is for those who live in thatched houses, or those that live in more modern housing with metal or tile roofs, and you can imagine sharing this and clicking on the link and twiddling the knobs in any way you want to ask about relationships to ownership of bicycles or socioeconomic status or travel or age or height or hair color or whatever else you might want to ask. But once again, we haven't made any effort here to ask whether these differences are statistically significant between these two graphs. This is really just a discovery tool allowing people to explore that then lets them extract the data to analyze in a more comprehensive way. So I think that is that's all I wanted to say, but I wanted to kind of end up with a couple of questions or pleas maybe for further discussion. One is, what tools or data do you want or need? Or what tools or data have you generated and need to make available? how do we make that information, how do we make that information available, which is not a trivial matter for large scale data sets or tools for analysis of that. How do we make it not just available, but accessible to people, especially people who are not necessarily specialists in the area, in the same way that all of us use apps for looking at weather satellite data without being weather forecasters or cold. And what other questions? What are the questions that we want to ask, and so dictionary cellology. So I think I'll stop there, and maybe we can open it up for further discussion.
One thing that I hoped to do for my own database, but I never did, but I'm sure it would help, is a YouTube video of what can be done.
Yeah.
Like with the mouse clicking, like you can do this, you can do that, and that would make it more accessible.
Yeah, I agree. So all these things take time and effort, and for us, so for our database project, which is not a research project, it's a service project. It's supported entirely by staff. I won't hire postdocs or students on that project for obvious reasons. It's exploitative of students and postdocs in that I can't very well go to a student and tell them, I know you're planning on graduating in June, but you're gonna have to put that off because I need you to work on another project. And an even worse problem, in my experience at least, is that students and postdocs don't write Russian level code. That is sustainable and that we need to be able to run, year after year. We're going through, so those of you who work in the fungal community may be familiar with this now. There's a really bad vibe going around because most of the genomic resources that were developed at the Broad Institute are being shut down over the last couple of months. So the Ospra database has gone away, the Aspergillus database has gone away, mucal mycosis database has gone away. Support for these databases is a challenge. The Arabidopsis database has moved to a fee-for-service model because supporting these is.
How do you pay all these people?
So they're paid by various different groups. I mean, the major source, about 60% of our funding, comes from a contract from NIAID. It's not a grant. That's the right way to fund things, but it's a real headache. I mean, it means it's like a contract that the city of Santa Barbara puts out for paving the roads. And unlike what we do in a research, so I may write a grant to study the apicoplast and decide that there's not much more we can contribute to that, so I can use that money for something else, and whether that is of interest is sort of between me and the grant or paper reviewers. But if the city of Santa Barbara hires somebody to pave the roads, they don't want to hear, I decided to put in new streetlights instead. So that's the major source of funding, but there's also support that comes from the Gates Foundation and the Wellcome Trust and the World Wellcome Fund and the Australian government soon, I hope, and the Brazilian and Chinese governments. So, but your YouTube video, so there's a YouTube channel with about 60 videos that are up.
In Europe, because now it was Israel, there is this generic framework for infrastructures, the S3s, and of which Elixir here, which is my informatics infrastructure, has been the top ranked one, and it's already funded. It's really part of the library report thing. And so there's now funding channels throughout Europe that are European channels for funding of these, and also a national roadmap to infrastructure that we are required by European law, for which now we can have channels for sustainable funding of computational infrastructures. Different countries are in different stages of implementing them, but this is something that funding of this is always an issue for them.
Well, it'll be a challenge. I think it's an exciting development in the EU as to how that has developed, but it'll, my guess is it will be a challenge, as it has certainly been in the US and the UK, in that metrics for evaluating success are very different, right? If people don't use it, so this resource, the UPAP database, costs about $7 million a year. Right? If it isn't used, we should shut it down and send that money elsewhere. I, for one, would be delighted. You know, I get right to doing what I, you know, it means that you heard from Julius about some parasites they're working on. It basically means his lab's share is about $1,000 a person. So if it doesn't expedite your work by $1,000 a person, we should pull the plug and we should spend that money on something more interesting. But it, I mean, the metrics are just very different. It's sort of analogous to, in our computational work, the work, the only substantive algorithmic contribution that my group has made in the computational biology arena is in methods for ortholog detection. It's actually used. We've done a lot of other things that are actually probably better, but maybe have contributed to stuff that you or others do, but they're gone now, right? Because we've never invested the effort that we, and haven't thought it worthwhile to invest the effort to use it. It's a huge cost. Production is just different from research.
But hopefully we want to take 3D complex in the production level into the appropriate funding channels. When this goes to, I think, Emmanuel has contributed something I think is unique, which is a means to conceptualize and compare a micro-molecular assemblies. The question is good or bad, but it's the only objective means that we have
so
right now to study.
The number of visits per day is, it's judged by the number of visits, it's really crafty.
Personally, I think the most useful metric, that, I mean, we're all interested in impact, right? I mean, not impact factor, which is a different matter altogether, but what the actual impact is and how that manifests. Personally, I think the most useful statistic is the number of, for a website, is the number of repeat visits you get. But not the number, I mean, whatever numbers I put up here, right, it pales by comparison with Amazon or like, you know, any commercial website. But the average user comes back. So Julius, does that ring true to you? Would you guess that the average trypanosome researcher in your lab uses these resources on average once a week?
Could be somewhere around that, yeah.
So I think that's a, you know, I can't remember what the return usage statistics are for PDB, for example. But they're roughly similar. I've talked to Helen some years ago.
Comment about orthologs, which it seems to me is not a really a computational question whether things are orthologs. Like whether things are related, you can think of that as a computational question, because you can do, you know, blast statistics or something, and you can say if it's a strong hit, these had a common ancestor. But then distinguishing ortholog from paralog seems to be a little bit more subjective, because you have to come at, really what you want to know is, do these things have the same function?
Yeah.
And you can't tell that by looking at them.
I completely agree. So there are a lot of interesting computational questions that should be applied to ortholog detection, including improved clustering algorithms. But my number one goal would be to develop scale-free tools for assessment, because as you say, what the dividing line between, so first of all, this issue from the strict definition of orthology says nothing at all about function. But we have co-opted that in the sort of genomic,
it's really what we want to know.
Because we're in, well, those, the people who developed the term ortholog would not, so Eugene Koonin, for example, would argue strongly against that point of view, but I agree with you that in practice, the vast majority of usage are for functional inference. And the issue is, as you allude to, right, that if one man's ortholog is another's paralog. I mean, to me, if an ortholog detection algorithm groups alpha tubulin with beta tubulin, that's bad. But I don't really care about alpha 1 tubulin, alpha 2 tubulin, and I don't know, probably somebody like Monica or somebody who knows and cares more about microtubules say, oh my God, you can't include those, they're totally different function. And if you're E. coli, you know, alpha tubulin, beta tubulin, whatever, they're all the same. The issue of detecting orthologs isn't a computational issue, but developing tools to, especially in a scale-free way, to ask that, layering on additional information that emerges that we're now beginning to be able to generate from a population standpoint, statistical issues. There are a bunch of computational questions to ask.
I'd say that Gene Koonin is going to be here. He's here the week of the 14th.
You won't be here.
So we make use of various gene cluster databases. One thing that I've never seen in any of those is which cluster is this related to? So they made some decision to split this one up.
Exactly.
But you don't know that it's very similar to that other one, and that with some other algorithm you could have grouped those into one.
Yeah. So we've given quite a lot of. One of the things I'm supposed to be doing while I'm here is writing a new one for the research grant, which in part involves this. We've developed internal metrics. For comparing, which we do look at one release versus another to ask what changes. And there's no reason at all not to implement that for comparison between different ortholog detection algorithms. And I think that's a really good suggestion, in part because the people who get into this kind of thing, like, spend their forever beating each other over the head about who's right about whether things should be grouped or split. And for the mass of users who want to know, it would be useful to say, you know, for this 90% of proteins, more or less, there's no debate, right? Everyone's ortholog detection algorithm makes the same call. For these 9%, we all might make a call, but nobody has a clue.
So can you say in words, what are the, or is there some like fundamental difference between osophies and what?
Oh yeah, they're loads of different strategies. So
can you say it?
Major methods include similarity-based methods based on sequence similarity, say blast searches. Structural-based methods, phylogeny-based methods, syntony-based methods, and
they're identified as such. So I could go and I could say, I'm going to do this one, this one, this one, this one, and get the same answer.
So there are a bunch of problems with that. So usually they're not, I mean, in fact, never are they run on the same data sets. In fact, they don't all use the same reference yeast proteome. This was a big discussion. There is an entire meeting devoted to this, the Quest for Orthologs meeting, every couple of years, most recently in Barcelona. And there's lots of efforts to try to develop consensus proteomes and a consensus data sharing framework and web service based queries that allow people to interrogate across different databases so that we can use something like an algorithm like ours or an interface like ours, an algorithm like you suggest for comparison that would allow people to do exactly that.
The reference proteome is a big problem. If a student comes and does use one reference proteome, then the next year you do it again.
It's a huge problem. I mean, we have about 1.5 FTEs to do nothing but source reference genomes and radiomes. A really boring job. And, so we've tried for the organisms that we support to be able to make a reference to that. I mean, there are lots of technical issues involved in this, including some things that seem trivial, like, for example, as far as GenBank is concerned, I'm the owner of the toxoplasma genome annotation. So if you have something that is just objectively better by any criteria, that doesn't mean you can go in and change it.
Is there some kind of wiki for resources and with simplified protocol? So for example, I know using PAML, PAML is very powerful, but it's quite, I used it once and I'm scared every time to use it. Because,
everybody else.
So there is a documentation, but
It gets more complicated, and it's just I don't have any brilliant solutions. This is it doesn't either in terms of figuring out what's worth the effort. But I think that the databases that I reviewed that I think they're reasonably useful, although there are a million and one ways that they should be better. I'm sorry if they're not of interest to people who work on boring organisms like metazoa. But the difference between the first release, which was sort of one postdoc, 1 year project, and a multi-million-dollar project is what it costs to make something usable. It's the same as any kind of difference between research and production.
Imagine if I tried to challenge you to go a little bit beyond sequences. Because to some extent, this is probably of everything we study in evolutionary cell biology. It's probably the part that we have the most solutions where the barrier to knowledge is lowest. But if we go to simply any type of phenotypic data, everybody goes into denial and runs away to,
image data, for example.
The image dynamic, that doesn't really matter. The point is that cells are not genomes. They supposedly are genome just instruction. We don't even know what they do very well. So I think this is, if we are to do anything to understand how cells behave, how they become to be, how they become to be what they are, we need to go beyond just looking at sequence gazing and going into, okay, what do they do? And I think this is where, as a community in general, we've been very reluctant. And when getting one microscopy image was very complex as a whole PhD project, maybe this was excusable, but now the microscopes are robots. We produce data at any level, being it interactomics, transcriptomics, proteomics, any image omics. You just produce everything in massive amounts. And everything that we've done for sequencing, which we've basically developed a whole framework to study it, we now need to do this for all scientific data. So one thing, and I want to put this on the table, I would like to represent what a cell is. I don't think the genome is a good representation of what the cell is. And the cell is at least a spatial construct with some dynamics inside. I believe there are methods that are out there that are useful. But this is something that I think that once we have done that, genomes will be interesting. So then I think we just, as you heard from Vocative here, we just doing these very intellectual exercises that don't really solve any problem. So,
can you speak to what?
So all these phenotypic data that every lab is generating, your lab is generating, everybody else is being generated, we need to have somehow formal ways of dealing with them, the same way that we're developing for sequences. We need to be able to describe them in what we call the Trinity code, this thing that this woman developed, these one-letter codes, this is a representation. We don't have these representations of telephysical data.
I see. So you want to develop this so that you can have
Then you can store it. It doesn't have to be images. No, there's lots of biochemical data about rates of reactions, mm-hmm. which that I have a really, I find it very beautiful every time a molecular biologist stands up and says, and now I'm going to draw you the model. And then there's one circle followed by one arrow, and then another circle followed by that arrow. And that's what's
so that the model. It could all be contained in a relational database.
But in that, the real model will have dynamics to it. And these dynamics, we don't know how to compare it.
Yes, but to get there, you need these data to be coded in some way that they can fit into a relational database, so that the metadata can connect from one to the other.
Let me just take the word relation, because you don't need it to be relational. There's other frameworks, like semantic web, that are much more appropriate for these types of things. But yes, database, that's comparable. Where we now can compare things.
Where one type of data can be linked to the relevant other type of data. That's all I mean when I say that.
There's things like that in neuroscience, you have things like the Allen brain map, where you go in and you look at the cell, you get the see the genes that are associated with that cell, with a lot of this hybridization data. You can go across species, you go across imaging studies. So I think there's fields where that kind of thing is emerging.
But that's like one concerted effort, right? That was the nice thing about that.
Well, it's done in a pretty clever way, actually. Right. It allows people that certainly save the deliverance, and it also informed to try to advance the tools that allow people to ask their own questions. So, I mean,
But the data was all generated by somebody figured out how to do the data, and
There's additional data that go. Winds up. Continues to be added.
There's huge amounts of additional data. There's ways now
we can go try to get
the physiologists to talk to each other. So not just the anatomy and the molecular biology, but also the spiking signaling physiological data. Also, we can put it orthogonally to the other capabilities.
So I think, raised this as a provocative suggestion, but I guess would we all like to have a representation of ourselves? Sure, of course. But the challenge is that we're still struggling to figure out what we mean by that. So I think that a bottom-up approach is probably more realistic. I mean, this isn't like, I don't know, a classic a CS problem for the traveling salesman algorithm, where if you're working in the telecommunications industry, you ask somebody to develop the provably best solution for routing your phone call from Santa Barbara to Lisbon based on costs and whatever other parameters that you provide as priors. Unless you can write down what you mean by a cell, it's sort of futile to try to do that. I think that a bottom-up approach is likely to be more effective. But certainly, I mean, our challenge, Cassandra raised the issue of capturing metadata associated with images. This is something that the neuroscience project have dealt with for a long time, and we've tried to deal with some of the clinical data I talked about briefly. And if you sit down and say, here's a list of all the data, all the metadata that you need to capture for every experiment, nobody's going to do it. And nobody will do that unless they can actually see where it comes back. It's not that people don't recognize it's important. And I think it has to emerge from us as a community about what the information is we want to capture.
Might be interesting to think of a list of phenotypic characters that we want to know about cells. So if we want to describe a cell and say it has this feature and not those, what are these features that we're actually interested in? And could we ask a question like, how similar are two cells? Like what fraction of important characters do they share or not?
Like the intent to build up from the beginning, just like adding out, we want to know the distribution of patient age, whatever. It might be easier to start with like one characteristic. We can talk about cells according to their size. Oh, but then there's someone else that wants to know something else. Then build up instead of from the start trying to agree on a set of characteristics.
Because you'll change it constantly, right? And you'll eventually get to some stable, maybe. As projects mature, they get to some stable framework, but until we know about that, and defining the ontologies behind these is really hard and time-consuming work.
That's usually where things start. An ontology group will get together and just hash it out over years, and there's an ontology that's developed that can serve as a starting point.
And there's been a lot of effort for that, for developing for phenotypic information, largely through the GO consortium and the larger OBO group, whatever, ontologies for biological observation, is that what OBO stands for?
There's an NSF-funded research coordination network that I'm pretty sure is still alive. They have a couple years left called Phenoscape, and that's exactly their name, and they can give you money to do this type of thing. So a lot of ontology groups are working under them while they're alive.
The problem with ontologies, I shouldn't say stuck with the problem, because we just invested a huge amount of time in developing a new methodology for exactly to describe cellular features and trying to go beyond just things with relationships and times and places. And ontologies in the end are very good to describe things and relationships between them, but then the moment you want to add time, ontologies start breaking apart.
Maybe for cell biology, not as you were suggesting, not in other areas. So certainly, there are very detailed ontologies describing time, like clinical studies, we're looking at longitudinal cohort studies. That's the whole rationale behind those studies. There are ontologies for designing time in neuronal development.
Pick up on something that you said about we need to define what we want and what does describe itself. But then you put something on the table. Now, this is something I've been playing with, literally just playing for a few years, and I said it's probably time to do something about it. You probably recognized my rant a few years ago, which I think that there is a very simple representation out there that has all the properties that we need to become the framework for comparative cell biology. It's called PetriNet. It's a modeling framework for process modeling. And it's a way, so let's first start by saying that a cell is a collection of things with relationships that automatically puts you into the network domain, where networks are basically systems to represent things and their relationships. And networks there's all sorts of networks out there and all sorts of formalisms to analyze networks, which means that if you manage to project whatever you do into any one of those formalisms, you gain automatically the tools associated. So as opposed to actually that's when we first met, we're actually trying to develop methods to parcelate networks to looking for what we now call functional modules in networks. We're just using simple network clustering algorithms like the MCL. And we're just projecting tools that exist. We didn't have to invent new math or anything. We just need to find the right math. But the problem of many of those methods that people use to describe biology is that they're very, very limited. There's very little information you can encode into them. One thing that there's a subclass of networks that's called bipartite networks, which you have a symmetric nodes instead of like that. And someone's developed a whole modeling formalism associated to these. PetriNets are basically networks where the notion of the thing and interaction have been made explicit. So you have a network of things connect to transitions. Places connect to transitions, that's the network. So places or states have the properties that things, you can color them, you can add properties to them, and transitions, again, can have properties associated to them. So instead of saying that a protein A binds a protein B, which in a typical, a normal network, I just put a circle, a line and a circle, and A connected to B, I'm not going to say protein A is a place connected to transitions called interaction. So protein A and protein B are two places connected to a transition that are going to give rise to state AB. That means that now I have a means to encode a the, if I want, kinetics of that association, because I've made explicit the notion of interaction. Now, why am I making these radicalities? It's that pecking nets, we have all sorts of tools associated to them. You have methods to do network alignment. So the idea of comparing systems would be immediately reachable. You have means to ask internal properties of the system. So what is the intrinsic topology of myself can be expressed as network properties, of reachability, and all sorts of other things, as well as the state of your knowledge about one specific self that you encode in this process. So what I've been trying to do is trying to write down the whole number system as battery net. It's big. And there's something, one part of the technology I still don't dominate, is that battery nets allow you to have nested systems. So you can have a place or a transition that is a whole subnetwork that you can collapse on demand or expand. The big advantage of this is that not only is it good for representation, but they have the added value that this is a modeling language. That means you can run dynamic processes here. So now I can express my different selves. And I can not only compare the structure of my knowledge about them, I can compare the dynamics because I can run the model. And again, if there's, and I think that maybe petri nets are not the best solution. There's more complex things like calculus out there. I can't even understand what they are. I've been trying to understand spy calculus forever and I don't get it. But some people say that they have the same properties and even better. But I think that constructs like this may contain them the representation systems that we need with all the properties to allow us to do comparative studies, with dynamic data, with any type of data that you want. But what touches my soul more deeply, which is dynamic data, which right now we can't encode in a comparative framework.
It's also really challenging to get dynamic data experimentally, right? I mean, I'm just trying to imagine what
dynamic data. There's a lot of dynamic data out there, actually. I mean, and you know, I mean, the other thing is that all the people, what they could do with it, helps to drive them to generate that data.
Yeah, no, for sure.
You know, we've seen that over and over again, using a similar framework to support many different communities. It's interesting because the people who work on, say, oh, cool, how come we don't have that kind of data? I'll go out and generate it. I think if you have a means of mining it, people will help.
No, I totally agree, but I mean, I guess I'm thinking about, not wanting to do this for one or two species, but for 10,000 species, mm-hmm. and I'm just trying to imagine how to do that. I've seen it done for one or two or three or a handful maybe, but that's the scale, it seems to me, of the question that Paul was asking. What are the measurements we want for those, if I understand it, thousands or so of different cells or different species?
So I think that in the past, this would have been unreachable because while we can sequence genomes and produce lots of letters very easily, producing some numbers is very complicated. But now we have these robots. They do those experiments for you. So in each of these wells, you're going to have some sort of color change, and that's going to, from which you're going to write your reaction. The biochemistry is just went into these crazy robotized
image. I think the frame challenge is the frame, we had a
great
talk.
Single cell dynamics now, we didn't change. Single cell biochemistry.
We had a great talk from Dan yesterday about the things they've been doing in their image database. And we'd love to make that available to others in practice. So my lab has generated tons of time-lapse data on the bugs that we work in. But to actually integrate that into that framework would be a huge task. So because it's been developed as a research project in this group, it isn't, and this isn't a criticism at all of what it is that they've done. It's just, it's hard. There's a huge difference between what we do in our lab and for our own research project that's sort of a one-off and developing something that's going to be sustainable and cost-effective. So my question about that PetriNet is because for our particular purposes, we would love to be able to use that. The question is how robust is it, how sustainable is it, how much development effort is there associated with it? If we invest and tie the community that we support into that, is it going to go away?
as has happened to us in the past. You know, all of these tools are modular.
I connect with it in 39 apparently. They are relatively recent tools. There's a lot of math because they are very using business. In terms of modeling business processes. They are qualitative modeling tools that are very good for large systems. Very large systems, they're not very good for very detailed systems, very small systems for which you want very detailed modeling. If they're going to stay or not, I wouldn't worry too much, because if they don't, it's either because they didn't solve the problem or something better appeared. I think that the big challenge here is the expression of knowledge into a network. Because every time I have a lot of theoretician around me, and every time a new graduate student wants to build a model, which that's what we'll be talking about, is building models of self, these students spend a year or two trying to express everything into small systems or differential equations. Now we'll be talking systems that are much larger. There's a lot more to do. So I tried at some point, right, to protein-traction networks and try to have automated ways of decomposing them into patching nets. It's not hard to do that. Doing that with metabolic networks is in the systems that exist today. It's not hard. People have done that. So it's relatively simple to say, I'm now going to go into a few cell types which does a lot of data, and I'm going to automatically recode everything in the patching net. And now I would say that interactions, metabolic reactions, all of these would be part of the phenotypic data that I would like to express, but there's much more. My problem is that there's much more, and this is where I'm drawing the blank. I have no other solution than brute force. Let's just code it into the network by hand. And this is where I think we have this huge insurmountable barrier at this point.
This is a non-linear system, so it means you have no clue a priori which of the parameters in the model would be important and which would be. I find it very hard to put this into a kind of large set database, because you don't know, where do I need to be very accurate in the measurement and where does it matter and so on.
Do you remember this talk we had the other day where the segment polarity network was discussed? Here's a question. I need to get this paper back up. We discussed with some students where I think it was the first full model that was published as Nature years ago on segment polarity network. Turned out that it doesn't really matter if you use a differential equation system with the best parameters you can, or if you just use a logical network, zeros and ones, no quantitative value, that the end result, the end state of the network is always the same. Were the seven stripes that we're trying to achieve. So, first of all, I think we put a lot of emphasis on dynamic, on the specific quantity that I think there are a lot of systems out there that don't depend too much on those. And so while I think in the end we'd like to have all the data that we possibly can have, right? So there's already partitions that, using a system as simple as protein-protein interactions, we know that you have protein-protein interactions that are stable, meaning that they persist over a certain amount of time and they have certain properties. We can infer those properties. We actually know from evolutionary loss regression, for example, automatically assume that this is going to be a stable interaction. So it's going to have a time in the range between X and Y, and others that don't, that are proteins that are more labile appearance properties that are going to be more transient. And this is something that, even though in a very qualitative way, and even in the absence of real data, in terms of the specific binding constant, for example, you can start adding qualitative data into the network and asking, and this is where I think it becomes interesting, where do I need quantitative data and quantitative representations to understand the system? Where do I don't? Because I actually have
reason. Maybe what I'm asking is, where do we actually need bottom-up research to really understand first why do we need those data? We have this discussion on orthodox where it's not even clear, right?
Yeah.
Well, I think we have a much better idea on orthologs than we do on the, on, of what, I mean, I agree with you that, until, I mean, you know, this isn't like a mature system for database. I mean, maybe because I don't work in the financial sector, I have no idea, but I'm guessing that, that the software, the databases that are used to produce my credit card bills are pretty much the same, whether they come from one company or another, or one bank or another. You're doing more or less the same thing, and it probably hasn't changed in years. But I think, and certainly, say, you know, part of the reason I was trying to tell the story of our experience, and many people here have similar experiences, that the research process is a process of learning what the questions are that we want to ask. So that's why I'd advocate more of a bottom-up approach, where you figure out what you want to do. I mean, it's a research effort to figure out what you need to do, and periodically you throw it all out and try to redevelop it in a more mature, robust framework.
But I think
I think I was going to say the same thing you submitted earlier, which is I'm sort of sitting here thinking, like, so we can't even agree on, like, orthologs. Like, I guess in my mind I'm thinking the things that you're saying maybe we should, we're done with, you know, DNA sequence. We, this is all easy to generate and things like that, but we can't even agree on that. We can't even agree about orthologs, and now it's hard for me to understand where you're going.
But the problem of orthologs is unsolvable, and this is, I think, we're wasting time because it's unknowable. We were not there. 75 million years ago, something happened. We'll never know what happened. We have a guess. And the moment we start treating ortholog mapping as guesses rather than facts, I think life will be easier because we really don't know.
But until we do, that's what we always do. And I want to issue with this issue about that not being able to decide about orthologs. It comes back, sorry, I've forgotten your name, but Paul's point, which is a, you know, a common one, that what's really useful is to provide a means for saying where, you know, where there's agreement and where there's disagreement.
Right. So that was what I was trying to ask you before, but it doesn't seem like.
So I would say, I mean, ballpark numbers here, but the same thing, so our first success with the Plasmodium genome database was in the first transcriptomic, genome-wide transcriptomic data sets were generated for Plasmodium falciparum back in like 1991, or maybe 2001. And they're very high quality data sets generated on an Affymetrix platform and also on a GlassLine. And you know, these are fundamentally different in lots of different ways. And you hear people who developed one talk about what they did, and with the impression that, oh, this is the way to go, and that other is just crap, and vice versa. And what was and we can all understand as researchers why they focus on why one system is better than another. But what was lost for the vast majority of users is that, you know, approximately 90% of the time they agree, despite the fact that these were done in different labs, on different platforms, using different strains, synchronized in different ways. 90% of the time they agree. 9% of the time, they basically agreed that they didn't have a clue. Right? You could make a guess, but it was a totally wild guess, not reproducible, not supported. From the community standpoint, the big success of this resources is the only, actually still maybe the only place where you can easily integrate traditional ready data sets of different types with RNA-seq data. And when a student in my lab can say, oh, you know, everybody always got the same answer, so I'll believe that, that's just, and it would be nice to do that with orthologs.
Yeah.
And there's no reason that
to acknowledge the limitations and not.
As I say, you know, we know this internally.
Yeah.
Probably everybody who generates an ortholog do this internally, because every time we do a new build, we want to know how similar was it to the last build, and what are the differences, and why shouldn't we apply that same protocol to compare our work-along groups with what the work generates, or Kim Schulander, or why can't, why shouldn't we compare what they do so that when you want to know whether you can believe that this gene XYZ1 in Pombe is an ortholog, if everybody agrees, you probably say, good enough for me. And if everyone says, yeah, no. Yeah.
I think I was trying to make earlier on, not so much that you need to build an infrastructure, like some patch nets or whatever else. That's, I think that in terms of research challenges ahead of us, I think representation of knowledge, of this complex knowledge, is a priority as research, not as, okay, let's talk about money to build a new database based on patronets or whatever.
So, just a funny story. I was interviewed at TTH for a position, and when then, so the committee asked me, so what do you want to do? And I told them I want to ease visualization of biological data, because I think it's very important to be able to identify things through visualization. And then there was a professor of fluid mechanics, I think. And so all you want to do is look for correlations. Is that what you want to do? And I said, yes. I think I didn't like it. Although I think every scientist, the goal of a scientist is to identify correlations.
Say that out loud.
Sorry?
Don't say that out loud.
Well, I mean, Western blood is a correlation.
I would say the goal is to, I'd probably put that differently. I would say, the goal is to identify patterns as clues for testable hypotheses.
Prediction, but I mean, the correlation is, in a way, has a predictive power.
Of course.
I mean, and therefore understanding.
I think we want to say we aspire to understand causality. Sounds better.
We want to understand. Okay.
So I think I have failed to create a mob of people going outside screaming petri nets now.
Well, but so what do you
want? Make us a YouTube video to convince us why this is. How
I haven't managed to convince a single student to do this. I don't think I'm going to go very far.
One thing I didn't understand on the different as you described, you said that there are two kinds of things, like plagiotizing and all of that, like things and processes. In your description, what would be these two kinds? What would be connected to what? Like cells to features?
So the fact that you have, that these are nested, you can have nested networks.
Yeah.
You can describe, one level can use the same network to describe, say, a vesicle being a state that that can go through process of transport, that can go through process of fusion that can give rise to the states of fused vesicle into organelle. And then you can open that up into all the homomolecular circuits where your place or your transition now is in a whole different network. So that's yet another advantage of these approaches, is that it's hierarchical. And depending on the level at which we want to study, sometimes you really want micro details, and sometimes you don't. You want to abstract them. But notice, I use the petri nets here as a theorem. I think they have promised. They need to be investigated as if they're useful or not. But it allows us to start framing what properties would you need from your representation.
The problem I see with any kind of representation of interaction network which you're talking about is that the network itself doesn't tell you anything about the emergent phenomenon.
Unless you can run a model on it.
Yeah, but that's very hard. I mean, ODEs, large ODE systems are very hard to run.
So, and this is, definitely are useful for qualitative modeling, so they actually do not, even though you can nest ODE systems inside them if you want, this is a qualitative modeling approach. They were exactly developed to model very large systems in a way that are computationally easy. Trackable. So obviously this is qualitative modeling. This is a very important limitation of this approach. So there will be many processes that are not well described by the model that you run on the representation. Notice, the model that you run on the representation, this is the wonderful thing about this. that you have that ability there. And but then you have the ability to nest that OBE systems inside them when you want.
Has done said at the moment it's even hard to have reliable binary interaction networks. So
but we have them for specific systems. So if you think out of the whole cell and say, I want to understand mitosis.
I was actually, the challenge I had, I mean, I think the cottage industry, as I call it, you have some specific question, you generate data to answer it. Like Dan Needleman's doc was brilliant along that way. And that can inspire lots of other people to do that type of setting. Mm-hmm. I was having trouble connecting that back to this sort of idea of scanning across large number of species mm-hmm. for things.
You know, developing a framework and that generalizes what else is hard. Yeah. And it's hard and it's expensive. But instead of just saying, in response maybe to Emmanuel's question, how do we sort of like implement it? Instead of just saying, oh, you know, it's hard and expensive, it's going to cost zillions of dollars. I don't think that's necessarily true. I think if you sort of there are lots of resources out there for integrating. And for accessing that, you know, we've had a lot of discussions about integration of image data into omic data databases with and so I think there are ways of trying to do that, and I think that funding agencies and others, in my experience, have been happy to support things, but only if you can prove that they really are used. And I think that's, you know, I mean, as a research scientist, I think that's a good thing. I hate it when I hear that somebody has spent gazillions of dollars building tools that sound good, but actually I don't want to use, and I wonder if not me, then why have we done it? Makes me sound feel more like a Republican, I guess.
Just describe the whole European Bioinformatics Institute.
Sorry.
Completely correct thing to say, but
you'll recall it.
Well, I think EBI has actually done a reasonably good job of, although without explicitly articulating the relationship between research and service, have done a reasonably good job in a lot of the service activities that they provide, and certainly generate a lot of interesting research. I do think that it would be worth explicitly articulating those boundaries a little bit better than
it's done. The political thing actually should be standing here defending the European model.
Sure. No, I'm just, it's difficult.
The approach is actually getting good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the approach is required in ways that I believe are sustainable and quite useful. I've been pleasantly surprised, and there's some signs of similar developments at JGI and elsewhere. I won't hold my breath about Genoscope, but we're at three. This is probably fuel for further discussion over coffee or a beer or whatever someplace.
And you two are both here for all of this week.
I
can talk to you.
I'm around until the 9th, I think.
I'm here till the... I was going to say, I have email, but that's not very reliable.
Or you read it, but you don't answer it.
You know, I actually just don't read it anymore. Just... At some point, you just accept defeat.
Thank you. I think you can start a conversation. Thank you.